Coming up on Star Stuff, Jupiter's long been called the king of planets, and now we finally have a model to explain how it was made. Rosetta survives intact as its comet 67P reaches perihelion, the closest point in its orbit around the Sun. And new studies try to narrow the candidates in science's search to understand the mysterious forces of dark energy and dark matter. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
Astronomers have developed a new model to try and explain how giant gas planets such as Jupiter and Saturn were formed. The findings, based on computer simulations, are reported in the journal Nature. The study's lead author, Dr. Hal Leveson from the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and colleagues used computer simulations to model the evolution of gas giants in our solar system. Scientists already know the gas giants Jupiter and Saturn, which are mostly hydrogen and helium, had to form first because they needed to accumulate their huge gaseous envelopes before the young sun's powerful solar winds blew most of this gas away. Observations of other young star systems have shown astronomers that the gas disks which form planets usually have lifetimes of only 1 to 10 million years. That means that the gas giant planets in our solar system probably formed within similar timeframes. Now, in contrast, rocky terrestrial planets, worlds like the Earth, Mars, Venus, and Mercury, probably took at least 30 million years to form and maybe as long as 100 million years. So, how could Jupiter and Saturn have formed so quickly? The most widely accepted theory for gas giant formation is the so-called core accretion model. Now, in this model, a planet-sized core of ice and rock forms first. Then an inflow of gas and dust attaches itself to the growing planet. The problem with this model is the amount of time it takes to accumulate a solid core roughly 10 times the mass of Earth, which is needed to gravitationally attract the planet's massive atmosphere. Yet somehow, these large objects, which are akin to Uranus and Neptune, only take a few million years to form. Now, in the standard model of planetary formation, rocky cores grow as similarly sized objects slowly accumulate and assimilate through a process called accretion. Basically, dust condenses out of gas in the protoplanetary nebula, eventually forming larger and larger bodies, initially through electrostatic charge and later through gravitational forces, until planetesimals, protoplanets, and eventually fully fledged planets are created. However, computer simulations of this model tended to produce hundreds of Earth-mass planets rather than just a few 10 Earth-mass cores large enough in a short enough period of time to explain Saturn and Jupiter. A new model developed by Leveson and colleagues show how the cores of planets as big as Jupiter and Saturn could have formed well within the 10 million year time frame if they grew by accumulating a huge population of icy centimeter to meter sized pebbles. Now, other research has already shown that gas can play a vital role in increasing the efficiency of accretion. So, pebbles entering orbit can spiral onto a protoplanet and assimilate, assisted by a gaseous headwind. The authors show that a process they call slow pebble accretion can allow a few giant planetary cores to grow from a sea of small pebbles which accrete into planetesimals. Leveson says, crucially, this model results in 1 to 4 giant gas planets, which is in agreement with the observed structure of our solar system.
If you look at our solar system, there are a lot of things that we don't understand about how the planets that we see came to be, right? There are issues concerning the formation of Jupiter and Saturn, which is what we addressed in our recent paper. The classic models of planet formation simply can't build those objects. They consist mainly of hydrogen and helium, and as a result, right, they have to form before the gas disk that we see went away. Observations across the galaxy seem to indicate that time scale is something like a couple million years, and getting something as big as the cores of Jupiter and Saturn to form that fast has been a huge problem. Jupiter and Saturn are unique in the solar system because they are made primarily of hydrogen and helium. But we believe early on they started to form out of solids, first forming a core of something like 10 Earth masses of ice and rocks. These objects probably looked a lot like Uranus and Neptune. that we see today. And then they very quickly accreted an envelope of this gas directly from the solar nebula. So the cores that we see, the cores in the center of these planets had to have formed very quickly.
And that's the thing, isn't it? How could you get those cores forming quickly enough? And to try and answer that question, you've carried out some computer simulations.
Yeah, so what we did is we invoked actually an idea that's not our idea. We had to modify it in order to get it to work, but an idea that's been floating around the community for the last 3 or 4 years called pebble accretion. The standard picture of planet formation is that you start off with pretty much dust in the protoplanetary disk, and it grows by eating each other to form rocks, and then the rocks grow by eating each other to form mountains, and so on, all the way up to the planets. And it turns out that picture doesn't work fast enough in order to get the cores of the giant planets to form. So this new idea called pebble accretion is that the growing planets eat objects that are something like 10 centimeters in size directly as they grow. And you can show that that leads to very fast formation times.
Does that solve the meter barrier as well? How do you get grains of dust forming meter-sized objects? That's another one of the big issues, isn't it?
That's right. So it's related to that, okay? So the basic picture that I think is emerging is that the idea of two-body coagulation, right, where these things eat like-size objects, probably work up to something about the size of a few centimeters. Then the interaction between those pebbles and the gas disk actually concentrates the pebbles in clumps that become gravitationally bound and then collapse to form the first real macroscopic objects in the solar system, the first planetesimals, if you will. And those objects form very quickly. So if that picture is right, okay, of the first steps, you go directly from a population of, again, pebble-sized things to objects that are 100 to 1,000 kilometers in radius, almost overnight. So that's sort of the first step of this pebble accretion scenario. And then those bigger things can very effectively accrete the remaining pebbles or pebbles that subsequently form in order to get the planets that we see.
So we get this fairly rapid accretion overall because that gas is going to be blown away if it doesn't accumulate around the core. That gas becomes part of the Kuiper Belt and beyond. So you've got to get that gas firstly. Once you've got that gas, that gives you a time frame, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's observationally constrained, not in our own solar system, but by looking at disks around other stars, particularly young stars, we can date how long these gas disks last. And it's very short. You know, it's one of the ironies of the game that I play, that the largest planets in the solar system, Jupiter and Saturn, have to be the oldest, had to form first. Because again, these gas disks say they formed in only a few million years, while the Earth probably took 10 times as long to form. Right? We know that by just looking at the chemistry of the Earth, that it took somewhere between 50 and 100 million years to form. So that's a huge difference, right? And that's what we're trying to explain here.
We've also got that issue of the grand track of the large planets towards the inner solar system, then back out again. That changed the way the inner solar system formed too.
Well, if you believe that model, which
okay.
I tend not to be a big fan of that model. I think it has a hard time explaining some of the observations, particularly of the asteroid belt. But we'll see. We'll see. Right now, it's the only explanation we have to explain why Mars is so small, for example. And that's, again, one of these big problems in planet formation.
Also, it's got to be able to explain why we only have four planets in the inner solar system rather than a couple of dozen like some exosystems of Uranus.
Well, we'll have to see about that, right? The objects that we see around other stars tend to be bigger than the Earth.
That's right, yeah.
And so the interesting thing about those things is they're closer to their stars than we see in our own solar system. So if you were to ask me 6 months ago, what are the outstanding problems of planet formation in our solar system? And I would list several. The first, which I think we've now solved, is how do you get the cores of Jupiter and Saturn to form so quickly? The second is why Mars is so small, right? And as you said, there's this grand pack model that can potentially explain that. The third is why we don't have any planets inside the orbit of Mercury. and why Mercury is so small. And the other one that I would put in that list is why there's this dichotomy between Jupiter and Saturn, which have a lot of gas, and Uranus and Neptune that have almost no gas. I've expected to find planets that are sort of half gas, and we don't see them. That could just be small number statistics, but I think that that's a problem as well.
On a question of etiquette here, I tend to call Uranus and Neptune ice giants rather than gas giants. Am I right there, or is, well, how would you describe them?
I think that that's typically what's now done in the field, right? You know, when I was young, they would just call them all giants.
Yeah.
Gas giants. And, you know, if you think about it, Uranus and Neptune are mainly gaseous. So that's not a bad thing to say, but their composition looks more like comets. They essentially grew from comets in a similar way that the Earth grew from rocks. Okay. Mm. And so I tend to think because they form differently and because they're really compositionally different, it's justified to list them as a different type of object. And so ice giant sounds good.
That's Dr. Hal Leveson from the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. The European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft has survived perihelion as its comet 67P, Sheremov-Gerasimenko, made its closest approach to the Sun, coming within 186 million kilometres of the solar surface. During perihelion, the Sun's heat evaporated volatile ices and dust in the comet, which erupted into space as powerful jets of gas and particles at a rate of over a tonne a second. Rosetta, which is the first spacecraft to orbit a comet, monitored the climax of 67P's explosive outgassing, collecting samples as they vented off the 5-kilometer-wide mountain-sized rock tumbling through space. Mission managers say Rosetta captured a range of scientific data which could help scientists better understand the origins of life on Earth. Pictures taken from Rosetta's navigation camera showed that comet 67P is very active, with its surface being constantly buffeted by solar wind and heat. During 67P's solar swing-by, Rosetta retreated to a safe distance 330 kilometres above the comet's surface in order to protect its star tracker navigation system from debris. Comet 67P is made up of minerals, ice, and, most critically for scientists, organic molecules that may have been similar to the precursors which started life in Earth's early oceans. You see, comets are time capsules containing the building blocks which formed our solar system. By studying comet 67P, scientists can better understand why our solar system turned out the way it did, why Earth has stable water, and the ingredients which allowed life to develop and thrive on Earth. Scientists are also hoping the heat of perihelion will have caused the comet to shed some of its thick icy crust. If so, it means the comet may be disgorging some of the pristine particles left over from the solar system's birth 4.6 billion years ago. The European Space Agency says Rosetta, which continues to circle the comet on its 6.5-year orbit around the Sun, is working perfectly. However, mission managers say Rosetta's tiny lander craft, Philae, is still silent after only a few brief outbursts of communications with the orbiter over the past couple of months. They're also concerned about some of Philae's equipment which may no longer be working properly. They're still hopeful that the lander could wake up again and transmit more scientific data as well as images from the surface. But Philae may have been out of contact for so long now that its transmission equipment has started to decay. One transmitter's already out of commission, and two of the lander's receivers aren't working properly either. NASA says the world can breathe easy as there is no giant asteroid hurtling towards Earth and about to wipe out much of the planet. At least not yet. The American Space Agency was forced to make the announcement following the latest doomsday claims by the same old less-than-reliable rumour mill blogs and yellow-sheet tabloid news sites. Their latest outlandish claims involved a mysterious giant asteroid crashing into the Earth in mid to late September, somewhere near Puerto Rico, causing major destruction throughout the region. Astronomers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, say the claim is entirely baseless, with not one single shred of scientific evidence to support it. NASA says all the known hazardous asteroids which have been identified so far have a less than 0.1% chance of impacting Earth within the next 100 years. If there were any object large enough to do the level of destruction being claimed is about to occur in September, astronomers would have been able to see such a large asteroid by now. It's important not to forget that the people making these claims are the same kind of doomsday theorists which predicted with 1,000% certainty that the end of the Mayan calendar in 2012 would cause death, doom and destruction on a globally cataclysmic scale, with the planets, the sun and the center of the galaxy all lining up to cause massive earthquakes and tsunami events. Of course, none of those claims were backed up by science either, and the people making them all turned out to be wrong. The ABC's very own Dr. Carl probably said it best when asked about the claims by a talkback caller on Triple J.
They're saying that it's on a collision course with Earth, and it's supposed to hit 2015, 2016. But if there's something, apparently this is the size of Jupiter, if there's something that big traveling through space, like, wouldn't you be able to see it, like, through telescopes, whatnot, if it was that, like, going to hit us in a year?
They're lying. There are thousands of astronomers around the world professionally, and hundreds of thousands of amateur astronomers. Amateur astronomers are now contributing so much because they've got telescopes that are smaller, but very high quality, and lots of them, and can be guided. And so they can just stare unblinkingly at a bit of a sky, and they discover so much stuff. With a naked eye, you could see something the size of Jupiter. With a telescope, you could see something the size of maybe Uranus way out there. If there was something that was going to hit, and the days are either 14th or 24th of September, the astronomers would already know. Could you pay all the amateur astronomers to not talk about it, whereas Anonymous is able to talk about it? No, they're just lying to you again. I'm sorry.
Conspiracy theory, is it?
Anecdotes are stronger than real data.
Well, yeah.
Sorry, Gav?
That was my belief as well, that it was I was ringing up as a skeptic.
So. Mm. Yeah, and the thing is that the world was supposed to end so many times. Remember the Mayan thing? World didn't end then, did it?
Oh, don't start talking about the Mayans again.
Oh, God.
Don't invite the Mayan calendar back.
Two new studies reported in the journal Science are helping astronomers eliminate possible candidates for two of the biggest mysteries in astrophysics at the moment, namely efforts to identify components of dark matter and dark energy, which together make up some 95% of the universe. Because scientists have no idea what dark matter or dark energy really are, it means science really only understands a mere 5% of the universe around us. Both the experiments reported in Science illustrate how basic questions about the universe's development can be addressed by laboratory-scale experiments. In one study, Eleanor April and colleagues, members of the Xeon Collaboration, have been trying to work out what dark matter is composed of. Scientists know dark matter exists because of its gravitational influence on normal matter. However, whatever substance dark matter is made out of can't be seen directly, and other than gravitationally, it doesn't appear to interact with anything, including itself. Previous models for dark matter have involved standard particles, things like neutrinos. But more recent studies of the physical processes forming our universe suggest new types of particles called weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs, are involved. Trouble is, we don't really know what WIMPs are, and that's where the Xeon Collaboration comes in. They're conducting experiments to see how some proposed dark matter particle candidates might interact with normal particles. Using a giant underground tank full of liquid xeon in Italy as a detector, scientists have been trying to determine if different kinds of potential WIMPs would interact with normal particles when they collide, in the process creating recoiling charged particles that will be visible in the detector. April and colleagues used this instrument to try and detect distinct signals from recoil. Unfortunately, nothing came up. But they're not seeing that as a failure. Instead, it's allowed them to rule out some set limits on several types of dark matter candidates which had previously been proposed. Meanwhile, a research team led by Paul Hamilton from the University of California, Berkeley, have been looking at a hypothetical force called the chameleon field, which they think may be a possible candidate for dark energy, that mysterious force which is causing the expansion of the universe to increase at an ever-accelerating rate. While not finding their elusive chameleon field, the researchers have narrowed the likely places such a field is likely to hide by about 1,000 times compared to previous experiments. Dark energy was first discovered back in 1998 when scientists observed that the universe was expanding at an ever-increasing rate, apparently being pushed apart by some unseen pressure, permeating all of space and making up 68% of all the energy in the cosmos. Since then, physicists have proposed numerous theories to try and explain all this mysterious energy. It could be simply woven into the fabric of the universe as the cosmological constant that Albert Einstein proposed in his equations for general relativity in order to keep the universe in a steady state. Later, Einstein disavowed those as his greatest ever mistake when it was discovered the universe really was expanding. On the other hand, dark energy could be quintessence represented by any number of hypothetical particles, including offspring of the Higgs boson. In 2004, theorist and co-author Justin Corey of the University of Pennsylvania proposed one possible reason why dark energy particles haven't been detected yet. Namely, they're hiding from us. Specifically, Corey proposed that dark energy particles, which he called chameleons, vary in mass depending on the density of their surrounding matter. So, in the emptiness of space, chameleons would have a very small mass and exert force over long distances, able to push space apart. However, in a laboratory with lots of other matter around them, chameleon fields would have very large mass and very small reach. That's because in physics, a low mass implies a long-range force, while a high mass implies a short-range force. This would be one way to explain why the energy that dominates the universe is so hard to detect in a laboratory. Put simply, the chameleon field is light in empty space, but as soon as it enters an object, it becomes very heavy, and so couples only to the outermost layer of a big object, not to its internal parts. When Hamilton read an article outlining a way to detect the chameleon particle, he suspected that an atom interferometer which had been built at Berkeley might be able to detect chameleons if they existed. These interferometers are among the most sensitive detectors of force ever built, and they're usually used to search for slight gravitational anomalies which would indicate a problem with Einstein's general theory of relativity. While the most sensitive of these interferometers, such as LIGO, are physically much too large to sense the short-range chameleon force, Hamilton and colleagues immediately realized that one of their less sensitive atom interferometers may just be ideal for the purpose. The team suggested measuring the attraction caused by the chameleon field between a single atom and a larger mass instead of the attraction between two large masses, which would have suppressed the chameleon field to the point of it being undetectable. So scientists dropped cesium atoms above a 1-inch diameter aluminium sphere and then used lasers to measure the forces on these atoms as they were in free fall for about 10 to 20 milliseconds. The experiment detected no other force than Earth's gravity, which the researchers say rules out chameleon-induced forces a million times weaker than gravity. As with the earlier dark matter force, this experiment effectively eliminates a large range of possible energies for chameleon particles. Experiments at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva and also at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Illinois, as well as other tests using neutron interferometers, have also been searching for evidence of chameleons without any luck. If nothing else, this research has allowed scientists to better rule out things which dark matter and dark energy aren't. That in turn gives them a better range of options as to what they may be. Japan's HTV-5 cargo ship, loaded with 4,309 kilograms of supplies, has successfully docked with the International Space Station, 5 days after being launched on an H-2B rocket from the Tanegashima Space Center south of Tokyo.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The engine's igniting, the solid rocket boosters, and liftoff. The White Stork is in the air, HTV-5 heading towards the International Space Station. Again, the first stage firing, those solid rocket boosters will continue to burn for just under 2 minutes. Along with the central portion, the first stage providing the initial thrust for the vehicle.
After liftoff, the launch vehicle operation control was shifted from the blockhouse to the range control center.
Just about 1 minute into liftoff, the solid rocket boosters about halfway through their life, the first stage continuing to burn.
JAXA, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, had postponed the launch twice due to bad weather conditions. Crew aboard the orbiting outpost used the space station's robotic arm to grab the cargo ship and dock it to the Harmony module. The 5.5-ton HTV-5 Nankun Ituri, which is Japanese for stork, is loaded with fresh supplies of food, water, clothing and equipment such as tools, spacesuit gear, parts for a new water recycling system, a galley and scientific experiments including a supply of whiskey, which will not be for drinking but will instead allow people to see how booze reacts in the microgravity environment of space. Also included is a special telescope designed to measure cosmic rays, which are some of the highest energy particles in the universe. The new telescope will be mounted outside the space station. It'll operate for up to 5 years, monitoring the constant stream of cosmic rays bombarding Earth from all directions. Scientists want to learn more about the composition of cosmic rays and exactly why they have such high energy levels. An Ariane 5 rocket carrying two new telecommunications satellites has been launched from the European Space Agency's Kourou spaceport in French Guiana.
À tous de DDO, attention pour le décompte final. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, top. Allumage Vulcain. Allumage EAP, décollage. Les paramètres bord sont normaux.
We had ignition. Our Ariane 5 begin her mission rising off the ground here in French Guiana. Right on time. We're fine now. The DDO says everything is okay on board. With our two passengers, Eutelsat 8WestB and Intelsat 34.
Ariane Space Flight VA-225 deployed the 5,782-kilogram Eutelsat 8WestB satellite into its geostationary transfer orbit 28 minutes after launch. The Eutelsat 8WestB has a design life of 15 years and will provide high-definition direct-to-home television broadcast services to the Middle East and North Africa and telecommunication services across Africa and parts of South America. 13 minutes later, Arianespace deployed the 3,300-kilogram Intelsat 34 satellite into its own transfer orbit. Intelsat 34 will provide media distribution services across Latin America and host a Brazilian direct-to-home TV platform. It'll also support advanced broadband services to maritime and aeronautical providers serving the North Atlantic over its 15-year designed lifespan. The mission was the 81st Ariane 5 flight. The next, scheduled for October, will include the first of Australia's NBN satellites. And that's the show for now. Star Stuff's produced by RN Science at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can ensure that you never miss an episode by subscribing to the show as a free weekly podcast through iTunes. Just type in ABC Star Stuff in the search box and click subscribe. Or you can download the show from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. We also have a Star Stuff blog containing all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular spacey images and other things I find amusing on the net. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations and publishing details, join the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed. Just type in the @ symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word and in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.